a staff writer for The New Yorker in 1996. He's the author of the best-selling book, The Tipping Point, How Little Things Can Make a Big Difference, which grew out of articles that first appeared in The New Yorker magazine. His profile of Ron Papale, the Pitchman, received the 2001 National Magazine Award for Profiles. His 97 New Yorker article, The Dead Zone, on the 1918 influenza pandemic, was the basis for the 2000 made-for-TV movie, Runaway Virus. His new book, Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking, was released in January. We are honored to have Mr. Gladwell here in Madison, and please join me in giving him a warm Wisconsin welcome.
From the Munich Philharmonic, and she tears it open, and it says, Dear Herr Cullen, we would be delighted if you wanted to audition for the role of first trombone in Munich Philharmonic. Now she sees that and she thinks nothing of it. She thinks, well, somebody made an error, you know, this happened, someone's secretary probably didn't understand, blah, 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 whatever. She packs her bags, she's living in Italy at the time, takes the train to Munich, and shows up at the Munich Philharmonic. Now the audition they're having that day is in their big main audition hall, a room that's beautiful and ornate as this. And everybody is supposed to play the same piece, which is Ferdinand David's Concertina for Trombone, which is the kind of war horse audition piece in Germany for trombone. And there are 32 people who are been invited that day to audition for this enormously prestigious post. And there's one weird thing about the audition that day, which they've never done before at the Munich Philharmonic, which is they have a screen they put up, so the people on the audition committee can't see the people audition. Now, like I said, they've never done this before, but in this case, it so happens that one of the 33 people who's auditioning is like the son or the nephew of someone on the audition committee. They just wanted to make sure that no one pointed the finger at them and said, accuse them of favoritism. So they have this big canvas screen. So Abby Cullen is number 16 out of 33. She comes out, walks in, sits down in a chair behind this screen, and she plays Ferdinand David's Concertina for Trombone. And she thinks she blows it. Halfway through, she cracks a G, and she's like, ugh, can't believe it. Came all the way from Italy to this once in a lifetime. I mean, how many times does the job of first trombone open up at a major symphony orchestra in Europe? You know, once every 25 years. These are lifetime appointments. And she says, I've come all the way, and I blow my big chance. And she's despondent. Packs up her trombone, she trudges back downstairs, she's putting on her coat. She's about to leave and go back to Italy. What she doesn't know is that the maestro is just blown away. Right? If you talk to people who do auditions, they will tell you that an audition is a classic snap judgment. Right? You make up your mind like that, boom. First three, four, five notes you know. And within the first three or four, five notes, the maestro absolutely knew. He was transfixed. He was like, wow, right? And he's so excited and so utterly convinced that this is his next trombonist, he sends the remaining 17 people home, right? I need to hear no more, right? I have found my trombonist. He turns to his assistant and he says, you know, go and fetch number 16, bring him back up here. I would like to meet the new trombonist from Munich Philharmonic. Assistant runs downstairs, grabs her just as she's going out the door and says, the maestro wants to meet you. She's like, the maestro? Why does the maestro want to meet? It's like, because you blew him away. She goes, really? Yes, really. Takes her by the hand, leads her upstairs, locks in the room, dead silence. And all she hears is, my God. Because they're expecting Herr Cullen, and instead, standing in front of them is the last person they would ever have imagined. Frau Cullen. Now that story, some unusual, because a similar kind of thing happened over and over and over again in this country in the early 1980s. Up until that point, orchestras in America, like orchestras all over the world, were all men. And if you ask maestros of orchestras, why do you only hire men? They would give you a very simple answer. They would say, well, because men are inherently superior classical musicians to women. And if you said, well, how do you know that, maestro? The maestro would say, well, we have auditions, right? We've got a chair right there, and men and women in equal numbers come, and they play the same piece of music, and the men are always better. So what are we left to conclude? But that men are superior musicians to women, right? What could be more fair and more objective? What could be a better way of determining who's a better musician than an open audition? We do that, and the men always win. What are we supposed to think? And if you go back and you reread music journals from before the 1980s, you can actually find long articles written by people speculating about why it is that men are apparently superior musicians to women. And all these had all kinds of theories. There were some who said, well, it's something about the soul of classical music, since it was composed, these things were all composed by men, you really need to be a man to represent that spirit with any kind of fidelity or skill. And others would say, well, no, actually, I think it has more to do with the genetic makeup of men. that they have the power and the physical strength and the hand size and the lung capacity to play classical music with the kind of gusto and brio and skill that's absolutely necessary. But nobody questioned the fundamental premise, which was that men are inherently superior to women. It was just a question of coming up with a reason why. Well, then in the early 1980s in this country, something happens. And that is that musicians organize and they form unions. And they have a series of changes that they bring to the workplace. And one of the changes is, you know, grievance procedures. And one of the changes is benefits. And one of the changes is, you know, pensions. And one of the changes way down the list is, oh, and by the way, we'd like you to use that screen, not just every now and again when someone's son or someone's nephew is auditioning, but all the time. I say, look, we just think the problem of favoritism is serious enough in our world that let's just take it off the table. Let's put up a screen all the time. And the minute they put up screens, an extraordinary thing happens. And that is they start hiring women. Not just here and there. Women all the time. So many women were hired so quickly after screens went up that between the early 1980s and the present day, the percentage of women in major symphony orchestras in this country has risen from about 5% to 50%. Which means that, if you just look at the last 20 years, women have won the overwhelming majority of auditions since screens went up. Which suggests, if anything, they're inherently superior. Now, that story interests me a great deal. Because the book I've written, Link, is a book about our snap judgments. It's a book about the kind of thinking that goes on like that. And I think we have a sense that this kind of thinking, right, the kind of instincts that we have in various moments, the times when we make up our minds very, very quickly, we have a sense that that kind of thinking is very transparent and simple. But it's anything but. The whole premise of the book is what seems like an extraordinarily simple and transparent judgment is in fact something that's enormously complicated. And all kinds of weird things are going on below the surface of our snap judgments. And if we are to understand how we make decisions as human beings, it is incumbent on us to try and peel back some of those layers and get a sense of what's going on in that 1 second, 2 second, half a second that we need, that we use to make this category of unconscious, instantaneous decision. So what I want to do is just walk through that story about Edwin Cohen and blind auditions and pull out what I think are the most pertinent lessons from that particular account of how we make decisions. First lesson, sort of the obvious, the thing that attracted me to auditions in the first place, and that is the notion that an audition is a snap judgment. I don't know anything about classical music. I had thought, when I heard about auditions, that the way you did an audition was, you invite, you know, 20 people, and they all play, and you take all kinds of copious notes, and then after everyone's gone home, you sit around with your buddies, and you have long arguments about who's good and who's not, and you're for your notes, and then you go home and you sleep on it, and then maybe you take some of them and you play the tape over and over again, you think about pickups and a new one.